So we're going to continue. Today's lesson is on the cardinal virtues. Last week was the three parts of morality, and to decide whether or not I'm doing a good job. Can anybody tell me any of the three parts of morality? Okay, so for the ship metaphor, it's don't run into each other, be seaworthy, right destination. And in terms of morality, that was what you're doing outside with other people, what's going on inside, and then destination of kind of what are we doing this for? Where are we headed? Who are we trying to have a relationship with? And that being God, of course, the God part of morality. So today is a little bit about the inside parts of morality, I suspect, talking about virtues of character traits and so forth. And maybe I shouldn't have said that, because my first question is, what is a virtue? If I say this or that is a virtue, what does that word mean? A desirable quality. Yeah. Any other adjectives you like? A behavior you'd like to emulate? Yeah. Okay. Character trait. Okay. All those, I think, pretty close to home. To give you a sense of what a virtue is, this isn't actually in the C.S. Lewis part. This is Ben's intro to C.S. Lewis. But there's, especially in Christianity, there's two main ways we think of right and wrong, and neither of them are necessarily right and wrong. They just, they both have a function. One way of doing right and wrong is rule-based ethics. And C.S. Lewis talked about that in the first chapter. It's good to have some rules, right? Rules keep you from, you know, sliding off the edge of the road and going off the cliff. So they're kind of the guide rails that keep you from doing anything outlandish, kind of show you where the hedges are, where the edges of the map are. But there are limits to what rule-based ethics can do for you. Rules don't really tell you what you're supposed to be inside. Just tell you what not to do. Kind of give you general guidelines. So the other kind of ethics is what's called virtue ethics. And what virtue ethics says is that for when we talk about right and wrong, it's never as simple as right and wrong. It's right and wrong and wrong. There's always a pair of wrongs. There's always something that's lacking and something extreme on the other side. And if you listen to Lewis talk about it, he says, Satan loves to get you to stand against this one so hard you fall off on the other side, or vice versa, right? So in virtue theory, what you're trying to develop is a balanced set of character traits that navigates between extreme behavior on either side, okay? Does that make any sense? We'll do some more explaining of it. But vices are the things on the outside. They always come in pairs. And then the virtue is the thing that's on the tightrope in the middle. So let me give you an example of one we won't actually talk about. So just to be a good example. Let's say the virtue we want to talk about is diligence, a good work ethic. What would be the absence of a good work ethic? Sloppy, lazy, slothfulness, right? Okay. What would happen if you had too much work ethic? Yeah, you might neglect other areas of your life, right? Okay. Be so career-oriented and industrious that you never stop to rest, you never go to worship maybe, you never tend to your family and needs. Maybe you work so hard your body deteriorates because you do more than you can actually do. And so this guy who's lazy looks at that guy way over there and says, I don't want to be that, and so he's lazy. And then the guy who works all the time 24/7 looks over here, I don't want to be lazy, and so I'm going to work all the time. And what virtue is saying, you should work hard. There's a thing called diligence and a good work ethic. But it's in between obsessiveness and laziness. Somewhere in between there is healthy, hard work. Does that make sense? Okay. So virtue ethics is all about finding the right thing in between two harmful things. It actually goes back. You can find it in some biblical passages as well as ancient Greek philosophy. Here's one of the Bible's weirdest passages from Ecclesiastes, which only makes sense if you're familiar with virtue ethics. Otherwise, it's just a weird passage. Solomon says, In my vain life, I have seen everything. There's a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and a wicked man who prolongs his life in evil doing. Be not overly righteous, and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out from them both. That's a weird sentence in the way we normally think about right and wrong. I promise you, I've never preached a sermon about being too righteous, right? You guys are doing too good at this Christianity stuff. You need to ease off it a little bit. Like, never have preached that sermon because we don't talk about it that way. And fair enough, that's usually not the problem, is we're doing too good a job of Christianity. But if you take it from a kind of virtue point of view and you understand that Solomon might be being a little bit sarcastic here, okay? What would be overly wicked? Well, I can guess what that one is. You know, I'm not here just sinning and doing everything wrong I can do. What would be overly righteous or overly wise? What might he be talking about? Yeah, so like Jesus critiques the Pharisees for tithing the spice rack, but not actually doing the really important stuff, right? They really thought hard about really particular things, were exceedingly righteous in some areas and not in others. And so they weren't going to be like those sinners, but neither were they actually good. So it's an odd passage, unless you think about it, as there's a ditch on either side of the road. And then he's being a little sarcastic with the word righteous. We usually don't use the word righteous that way, but you might put in, don't be overly pious or religious or superstitious or something like that. A word we probably use is legalistic, right? Don't obsess over small stuff. Solomon would know. I mean, the whole book of Ecclesiastes was, I tried really hard to figure everything out. And for 12 chapters, he says, that didn't go so well. Like, the more I thought about it, sometimes the more confused I got. And at the end, he says, fear God and keep his commandments, and that's good enough, right? If you go further than that, then maybe you went too far. Aristotle is the ancient Greek who talks the most about virtue. He's in the book you want to pick up, because I know you're all going to run home and want to read on this, of course. But one of my favorites, probably the book that got me started down the strange path I ended up going down. I had a high school English teacher. She was very difficult. And I think at that point we were all failing. And she says, if you'd like some bonus points, which I think was her scheme, actually, to fail us all and make us do more work. You're all failing, but if you'd like some bonus points, we're going to read Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics Thursday nights for the next several weeks. So we get together and read Nicomachean Ethics. And it's where Aristotle talks about what is a good life and what is virtue. And sure enough, he sounds a lot like Ecclesiastes and vice versa. He says, virtue then is a state of character concerned with choice, lying in a mean. Okay, a lot of words there. State of character, so it's a character trait. It's not just a decision. It's not one action. It's something you're going to do habitually, over and over and over and over again. It's concerned with choice. Your choices are going to come out of your character. Okay, you don't have to think about every possible scenario you might ever get into. You're going to develop a good character, and when you get there, you'll know what to do. And then lying in a mean means the balance. Like, it's in between two extremes. There's always going to be something on one side, something on the other. Okay. Augustine, later in the Christian tradition, talked about the virtues as well. And he said, I hold virtue to be nothing else than perfect love for God. The fourfold division of virtue I regard as taken from the four forms of love. He says, if you learn how to love right, you'll have all the virtues down, because they're all forms of love. What does it mean by four? Well, the traditional view in Christian history about virtue was that there's four cardinal virtues, the four fundamental virtues, four character traits that everybody's got to have to be decent. And pretty much everybody agrees on those, and that's the topic of Lewis's chapter tonight. Now, Christians also believe on three more, because we like sevens and we like threes. So in addition to the four basic virtues that Aristotle believed in, guys like Augustine and Aquinas, the Apostle Paul, would say add faith, hope, and love. And that's what takes you from being decent to being Christ-like. Okay. So the four virtues that are the basic virtues that we'll talk about tonight and talk about how, yeah, Christians believe in those two, are prudence, temperance, justice, and fortitude. The worst part is that they come with those words that are now archaic. When was the last time you used, maybe we probably say justice. Other than justice, when was the last time you used one of those in a sentence? They're not common modern English words. They've kind of dropped out of fashion. So we'll have to find some modern words for it. But those are the basic ideas. One at a time, prudence is the art of being thoughtful. So Lewis will say, prudence means practical common sense, taking the trouble to think out what you are doing and what is likely to come of it. Okay. One of the basic things about being a decent human being is to take a little time to think about your actions. Okay. So let's think about that as a virtue for a minute, in between two extremes. What would be a lack of prudence? Just, yeah, charge ahead and give no thought for any decisions you make. Thoughtless behavior. Plenty of that in the world, right? What would be an excess of prudence? So cautious you never make a decision, right? I'm going to think about every possible scenario to death, right? And never actually do anything. Prudence is the mean, where you say, I'm going to give a reasonable amount of attention to it. I'm going to think about it a while, and then I'm going to make a decision and go do something. I'm not going to spend all day thinking about it. Prudence is about common sense. Of course, the funny thing about common sense is there's no such thing, right? There's nothing common about it. We like to think there's such a thing as common sense. Common sense is what I have, right? Everybody thinks they have common sense and the rest of you are dummies. But turns out we'd like to believe everybody has common sense. And it's taking the trouble to think about what you're doing and what's likely to come of it. So what's likely to happen, Timothy, if there's rain clouds out and you leave the window on your van rolled down? It gets wet. Yeah. See? So prudence says, you got to roll that up, see? Prudence, yeah. Thinking of all the consequences. Almost again to they push that as far as they can down that direction of overthinking sometimes. In Scripture, we might take it from Matthew chapter 10, verse 16. Behold, I'm sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. One of my favorite passages, actually, in the New Testament. Wise as serpents and innocent as doves. He doesn't want us Christians to be schemers, to be manipulative, to be any of those worldly things. Neither does he want us to be stupid, right? Wise as serpents. It's okay to be clever. It's okay to be thoughtful about what you're doing. You read the book of Acts, I think Paul's a great example of this. When he interacts with people, very clever in the way he approaches people, the way he arranges his conversations, when he's on trial, the way he works the legal system a little bit so that he gets to say, well, so that he gets to preach the gospel as many times as possible, all right? He's very clever in the way that he does it. Wise as a serpent, but the difference is he's not trying to bite you. Harmless as doves. And I think that's the idea of prudence. Or as Luce would say it, Christ wants a child heart, but a grown-up's head. Be childish at heart and innocent, but you are supposed to grow up at some point and be a little more thoughtful. Children don't think about consequences. I don't expect them to, because they're kids. That's something that we are teaching them. When you get to be an adult, you're supposed to have learned the ability to think about consequences. What's the likely result of me doing this? And the more experience you have, the more likely you are to be able to do that well. Let's find it. There we go. Augustine, he said everything is about love. So he said, prudence is love making a right distinction between what helps it towards God and what might hinder it. So there's two things you can choose from. Neither of them right, neither of them wrong. Prudence says, which one helps me be better? Which one's going to help me get closer to God? That's prudence, kind of making the practical decision of what's going to get me towards my actual goal of growing in Christ. So does that mean I have to be smart to be a good person? Got to be prudent? That was the question. Yeah, quite a lot, actually, of a difference between prudence and intelligence. So you got to know my background early on was in astrophysics. And in astrophysics, in that community, you are around some very special people, right? To do that, your brain has to be wired in a particular way that may or may not have anything to do with prudence. And in that world, I remember about my junior year when the light bulb came on and I'm looking around at my professors and saying, I don't think I want to be one of these people. And it was the day that there wasn't an eraser for the chalkboard. And so rather than going to the room next door and getting an eraser, my professor took off his shoe and started wiping the board with his sock and thought it was a really cool idea. And I thought, okay, maybe this is not the life path I want to be on. Maybe these are odd ducks, okay? True story, really happened. And he was really excited about it, told everybody, I cleaned the board with my sock today. Yeah, bragged about it all day. Well, problem solving 101. Like there's a million other ways to do it. He went with sock. Yeah. So again, intelligence and prudence, not necessarily the same thing, right? That you can have an abundance of one and not the other. For that matter, you don't have to be particularly smart in the intellectual sense to think about consequences, at least short term. Okay. So Lewis says it like this. It is, of course, quite true that God will not love you any less or have less use for you if you happen to have been born with a very second-rate brain. Odie, you're welcome. That one was just for you, man. Love you. He says he has room for people with very little sense, but he wants everyone to use what sense they have. Right? If he only gave you this much, use that much. Use all of it, right? However much sense God gave you, use that much sense. I'm sorry, Odie, that wasn't very nice. Yeah. How did you think that was going to end? Yeah. Yeah. I know you're 12 and I'm not expecting you to be an adult, but how did you think this was going to end? I'm not asking you to play chess. Just play checkers for a minute. Not 12 moves out. What was going to happen one step after you did this thing? That's prudence. That's all we're asking for with kids. Look one step ahead, and that's usually plenty. So yeah, use every little bit you got, however much that is, and God will be very happy. Can we talk just for a minute about the way that he says second-rate brain instead of stupid? He's so kind. I like that. Yeah. Okay. Temperance, the art of self-control. When you hear the word temperance, what kind of comes to mind, or does anything come to mind for temperance? Sorry? Alcohol. Yeah. The temperance movement in history had to do with whether or not you ought to drink alcohol in American history. Like it was entirely. So because of that, in Christian thought in the last century or so, almost universally, when you say temperance, like alcohol comes to people's mind. And that's the debate from like the 20s, right? It's an old argument, but that's where it comes from. Lewis, who is not a teetotaler, said that's not what it is. He would say temperance referred not specifically to drink, but to all pleasures, and it meant not abstaining, but going the right length and no further. So temperance is the art of self-control. That whatever the pleasure is, do you have the discipline to enjoy the pleasure in an appropriate amount and circumstance? Okay. So what would be a lack of self-control? Eating the whole buffet. All right, to use our word from Proverbs, glutton, right? Or drunkard, right? To have no self-control whatsoever. Every time I partake of a pleasure, I take of it until it destroys me. Okay. What would be an excess of self-control?
Calorie counting.
Huh?
Calorie counting.
I was thinking maybe more like asceticism, like starving yourself would be one. Thinking that if I don't eat at all, that will make me more pure. Or any of the overt self-denial, like kind of stoic, I'm not going to enjoy life in any way, shape, or form because pleasure is bad. So that would be one end of the spectrum. And the other would be, I'm going to enjoy pleasure till it kills me. Okay. So temperance is, God made life to be good and enjoyable, and I'm going to try to enjoy it in the correct amounts and in the correct ways, in the correct places and times. Okay. The right length and no further.
And developing prudence.
Yeah, they are interconnected, by the way. These four do overlap. Prudence, thinking about the consequences of your actions. Should I have one more of those? What will happen if I do? See, thinking about consequences helps you to understand what's the right amount. Interesting. The passage that I was thinking of doesn't actually talk about alcohol. It talks about honey, you know, just to show that the idea applies to anything. It's not good to eat much honey, nor is it glorious to seek one's own glory. A man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls. Okay. So again, let's get it away from alcohol just for a second. What would your kids have every night for dinner if it was entirely up to them?
Something sweet.
Ice cream. We have to there has to be an adult within eyeshot of the freezer at our house because Calvin will sneak in and grab ice cream at any time of day. He has no temperance whatsoever about ice cream. Okay. And again, children, I don't expect children to. That's something they're supposed to grow into. But as adults, he says, you know, if you ate honey all day long, nothing wrong with honey, but if you ate it all day long, probably not good for you. Likewise, a lack of self-control. Paul, 1 Corinthians 9, 25-27, every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. It's like an athlete. Can an athlete eat anything they want? Not if they want to win. Can an athlete starve themselves and take no calories in? Not if they want to finish, right? That there is a proper balance of calories to exercise that you need to maintain if you want to be healthy. So self-discipline is the metaphor Paul uses to describe how he's managing his life. Augustine says, temperance is love giving itself entirely to that which is love. Temperance is love keeping itself entire and incorrupt for God. That is, if I love God completely, then everything else I love in moderation. God's the thing I love without restraint and the only thing. And so because I love God without restraint, everything else just kind of goes in its little place. When I start loving something else without restraint, I've kind of made it my God. So that's the way I'm supposed to feel about God. Okay. What if I lack self-control in one particular area? What if there's some particular passion or pleasure I'm not able to control? What should I do then? Also a question. Probably stay away from it, right? So Lewis would say, an individual Christian may see fit to give up all sorts of things for special reasons. But the moment he starts saying the things are bad in themselves or looking down his nose at other people who do use them, he has taken the wrong turning. There may be some area of life where you just have not managed to develop self-control. In that area, maybe abstinence is from whatever that pleasure is the only way that you can manage your desires. Okay? He says, fine, do that. But that doesn't mean everybody else is in the same boat. Balance is the goal. Temperance is the self-control is the goal. I think that's a pretty fair appraisal of the problem. Paul's point in Romans about what about food offered to idols? Paul says, I don't have any problem with it. But if it's going to trip you up, I won't eat it, at least not while you're looking. Justice, the art of being fair, This is probably the only word of the four that we use a lot in modern discussions, although we have a lot of different renditions of it. Now, just by virtue of where we are as a society, we have to put adjectives on our justice. So there's criminal justice, and then there's social or maybe economic justice or different kinds of justice. And so we've tried to like say, what would it mean in this area, or what would it mean in this area? It's kind of interesting. So Lewis says, we can keep it simple. It's the old name for everything we should now call fairness. It includes honesty, give and take, truthfulness, keeping promises, and all that side of life. So if you're wondering, I've already forgotten. Prudence, temperance, justice, fortitude. Honesty wasn't on that list. I think honesty, that's kind of a big deal. Well, it's because in traditional thought, honesty fell under the category of justice. If you said you were going to do something, doing that was just. It was fair. It's not fair to other people to tell them you're going to do things you're not going to do. Telling the truth is a fair and just way to treat other people. Keeping your promises, paying your debts was under the category of justice. Maybe, I don't know if it's a better word, but it's a word that could attach very easily and, you know, kind of get that sense of it, that of just being who you're supposed to be in relation to other people, in a sense. Yeah. All that side of life. It's nice. Yeah. From the New Testament sense, justice comes up a ton, or biblical sense, Micah 6:8. He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice, to love kindness, to walk humbly with your God. It is, right? Especially in the prophetic literature, if you read the major prophets and especially the minor prophets, they all the time want to remind you, hey, you know what God really wants is for you to treat people decently, to treat people fairly, to be just. In particular, justice in the Old Testament, at least, had to do with how you treated people who were less fortunate than you. That justice meant taking care of a widow. So somebody who was married or had a stable home life, there might be several people who look out for them and make sure they get justice. But who looks out for a widow and make sure she's taken care of? Justice meant looking after her. The fatherless. Okay. My job is to make sure Calvin and Lucas's life is fair and they're treated well. Who takes care of an orphan? So the Old Testament put a lot of emphasis. If there's somebody there who isn't being looked out after, justice is making sure that they are. So the same, I think it's Psalm 72, maybe. How about I turn over there? Give the king your justice. It's either 72 or 74, or none of those. There's 150 Psalms. I know it's one of them. It's 72. Had it right the first time. Give the king your justice, O God, and your righteousness to the royal son. Okay, what's it mean to be just? May he judge your people with righteousness and your poor with justice. Let the mountains bear prosperity for the people and the hills in righteousness. May he defend the cause of the poor of the people, give deliverance to the children of the needy, and crush the oppressor. What did a just king look like? He was a king who dealt judgment to people who were oppressing people who couldn't take care of themselves. He was the one who made things fair again in a world where people used whatever they had to make it unfair. That was just a just king, took care of the poor. Augustine, this one's kind of a stretch to me, but since I gave an Augustine quote for all the others, I felt like I had to. He says, justice is love serving only the loved object and therefore ruling rightly. Justice is love serving God only, and therefore ruling well, all else is subject to man. But because you're in love with God completely, then you don't feel obligated to go out and get what's yours and take from somebody else. You can treat them fairly because God's taking care of you, was kind of his idea. To me, that's a little bit of a stretch of what justice is, but he wanted all the virtues to be about love. So he says, well, I can make justice about love too.
And if we love God, we can also love
those who he need love, made in the image of God. Yeah. And the last one is fortitude, which I think the word we would more likely use is courage, or even bravery, but I like courage. So fortitude includes both kinds of courage, the kind that faces danger, as well as the kind that sticks it under pain. Guts is perhaps the nearest modern English. I forgot to do the vice thing. Okay, go back to justice for just a second, then we'll do fortitude. If justice is the virtue, what's a lack of justice? Oppression, right? You're mistreating people. What's an excess of justice? Purity, maybe. Oh, tyranny. I thought I said purity. I was like, I don't know what that. Yeah, tyranny, like oppressive in the other direction, a severity of law where you're executing jaywalkers and never issuing forgiveness for circumstances, you know, no grace whatsoever. I mean, that's just to like a dangerous extreme where you wouldn't want to be judged by your own justice because you wouldn't pass. Okay. So biblical justice is, again, somewhere in between excess and lack. Courage. Courage is the middle. Guts, he says, right? What's a lack of guts? That one's easy. Cowardice, right? What's an excess of courage? If you have a thing about risk, foolhardy is the old word that people used to use for it. So, I mean, there's a building on fire, okay? And you think there's someone in it. You refuse to go help them. It's a lack of courage. It's cowardice. You go in to help them. Courage. You go in again because you thought it would look cool to go into a burning building. This is not courage anymore. This is madness, right? This is an excess. This is risk taking for no particular reason, right? This is a young man's game. Makes no sense. Don't do this. So again, courage doesn't mean facing danger for fun. If you can avoid danger, you probably should, because prudence, prudence says think about the consequences of running into a burning building over and over again. Bad idea. Philippians talks about Christian courage quite a lot. Paul's our guy. He likes the word courage. It is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be at all ashamed, but that in full courage now, as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. So think about the life of Paul. Does he stop preaching the gospel when he's persecuted and threatened? No. So no cowardice. He's got courage. Does he stick around when the mob starts throwing rocks? He's okay with leaving town. Like, there are other towns to go to. He'll stay. And he stays probably, if you read Acts, sometimes he stays a little longer than you might have stayed. But he stays, and then at some point, it's like, okay, time to go to the next town. It's usually after the rocks start flying. He's like, oh, maybe the time to go was a few minutes ago. Yeah. But, you know, they let him down in the little basket, right? And there's other scenes where he escapes narrowly and so forth. He's not trying to get himself killed. Is he willing to die? See the difference? For me to live is Christ. Living's just fine. He's fine living. He's also fine dying. He's going to do the right thing. So that's fortitude, courage. Augustine, fortitude is love readily bearing all things for the sake of the loved object. Fortitude is love bearing everything readily for the sake of God. You love someone, you carry whatever weight it is. You have the courage to face whatever there is to face. Probably, though, the best line on courage from C.S. Lewis isn't even in Mere Christianity. Anybody know what the Screwtape Letters are? Okay, so when you're done with Mere Christianity, you go pick up the Screwtape Letters. And it's a fictional set of letters that Lewis wrote pretending that a senior demon was sending letters to a junior apprentice demon and telling him how to destroy Christians. And so it's everything that Lewis wants to talk about Christianity, only intentionally said backwards. So when it says the enemy, he means God. You know, the enemy doesn't want these people to learn, or the enemy wants these people to learn forgiveness. So teach them how to hate each other. Right. So it's demons discussing how to make Christians fail. And it's in that he has this line where he's trying to help young Screwtape learn how to teach people to be cowards. He says, courage is not simply one of the virtues, but the form of every virtue at the testing point, which means at the point of highest reality. A chastity or honesty or mercy which yields to danger will be chaste or honest or merciful only on conditions. Pilate was merciful till it became risky. So what the demon tells his apprentice demon is, you don't have to get them to give up all their virtue. Just make sure they don't develop courage. And then when it counts, they'll give up whatever virtue they had because they're not brave enough. So they can be honest when it's easy. Satan will let them do that. That's fine. As long as they fail when it matters. Oh, that hurts, right? That's a pretty good definition of courage. All the virtues at the testing point. Okay, before we wrap up and have some comments and discussion of that, he has a couple of final thoughts that he throws in at the end of the chapter where he's summarizing what Christians believe about in character. And he makes the point that there's a difference between doing and being, which is why we talk about virtue. There's a difference between doing some particular just or temperate action and being a just or temperate man. Someone who is not a good tennis player may now and then make a good shot. One of the things about Christian behavior is sometimes we overemphasize individual choices and we forget that the goal is to be a good person who will then make good choices. But the goal is the character trait that we're trying to develop, something more long-term than an individual choice. That doesn't mean individual choices are unimportant, because all those individual choices is how you develop a character trait. But it's more than any one of them. It's about a character trait. What Aristotle would say back in Nicomachean Ethics is, if you want to know whether something's good or not, imagine you did that for the rest of your life. Don't imagine making the choice once. Imagine making the choice over and over and over again every day for the rest of your life or for eternity. What kind of person would you be if you only made that choice? See, it's kind of the opposite of, so we sometimes say situation ethics, where like in a given situation, you just measure the pros and cons and do whatever right at the moment. Aristotle says, no, forget the situation. Ask yourself, if you made this choice for eternity, what would you become if you only ever made that decision? And that's and then the difference that Lewis wants us to pick up too. Is it's not just about doing, it's about being. Otherwise, he says, we might come to three wrong conclusions, because preachers like three. Apparently medieval scholars do too. He says, we might think that provided you did the right thing, it did not matter how or why you did it, whether you did it willingly or unwillingly, sulkily or cheerfully, through fear of public opinion for its own sake. I was having one of those, not here, so I'll just do that so you're not trying to look around the room and figure out who it was. At another church, once upon a time, was having a conversation, one of those awkward conversations where you have an unhappy church member and elder sit down and the preacher and, okay, what's going on and so forth, and discussing the worship service and how it should be. And I can't remember what the exact topic was, but one of the elders finally said, would you be happy in a worship service like that? The member said, it wouldn't matter. I'd be doing my duty. I remember kind of thinking, we might have missed something there, right? That if we're only here because there's a box and I have to check it, and I'm not going to enjoy that song, and I'm not going to enjoy that prayer, and I'm not going to celebrate communion, and I'm not going to give cheerfully, and I am there with a frown on my face because I'm supposed to be. Well, I got all the actions right, but not the being. I didn't become more Christ-like in any of that. I kind of missed the point. That doesn't mean what you do in worship doesn't matter. Just saying, character goes with it. Are we doing it for the right reasons? Or through fear of public opinion. Do we sometimes do a thing because I don't want to be the guy who didn't? It's not the same as being good. Why did Jonah go to Nineveh? Mostly because fish vomit stinks. I mean, mostly because that other thing didn't work out. Had he been able to get to Tarshish, that's where he'd have been. Couldn't get there. Okay, I'll go do what God wants. Was he happy about it? No. Was God happy with him?
No.
We might think that God wanted simply obedience to a set of rules, whereas he really wants people of a particular sort. Okay. That, again, you get into your head this idea that as long as I check the boxes, then God's happy. Not saying the boxes aren't important. You should check some of those. But the idea is to become the kind of person who does those things. We're looking at what you are inside. Is, to use the three parts of morality point, is the ship seaworthy? And then finally, and this might be my favorite, we might think that the virtues were necessary only for this present life. The point is not that God will refuse you admission to his eternal world if you have not got certain qualities of character. The point is that if people have not got at least the beginnings of those qualities inside them, then no possible external conditions could make a heaven for them. That is, could make them happy with the deep, strong, unshakable kind of happiness God intends for us. Okay. Lewis has a really strong view, to the point we may or may not share it, but he has a really strong view about what the afterlife is like. He thinks people are in hell because they want to be there. Hell is locked from the inside. That if you're proud, you would be miserable in heaven. And so you go to be miserable in hell instead. If you're greedy, you'd be miserable in heaven. So you just go be miserable in hell instead. In his mind, and that doesn't come out in this book necessarily, but if you read other stuff, you read The Great Divorce, which is a wonderful book he writes about what he thinks heaven and hell is like. And in his mind, there are a lot of people, and this is the story of The Great Divorce, is there's people in his version of hell somewhere, Greytown, and there's literally a bus that takes them up to heaven and drops them off, and some people won't get off the bus. They're like, no, that doesn't look fun out there at all. Take me back down. And some of them get off the bus and they don't like the grass. Like they're in this perfect mountain valley and everything's beautiful. And they're like, the grass is kind of hard. I'm going back down. Like they find something to be miserable about. And they were, in a weird way, happier being miserable. And so God lets them take the bus back down. Like, don't have to agree with that. But that's kind of Lewis's view, is that morality is more than just, are you going to do the right thing so God will let you into heaven? Are you going to be the kind of person that would even want to be in heaven? Why would God want to be with you? What kind of person are you is the better question. What are we becoming? Or if we did this, remember Aristotle's point, what if you did this same thing over and over again for 1,000 years? What if everybody lives forever and we become our character? What would we be? Some of us couldn't be in a heaven because nothing would ever make us happy, because nothing has ever made us happy in our lives. If you are miserable each and every day of your life through selfishness, greed, and pettiness, do you think there's any way God can make you happy in heaven? It's not that he's being mean. It's that you're being proud and hateful. No one wanted to be around you here. No one's going to want to be around you there. That's overstating it, but that's Lewis's point. Take it or leave it. All right. Whoop. Discussion questions, and then we're almost out of time, depending on which clock I choose to use. Here are my discussion questions. As always, you can read them or ignore them or do whatever you want and ask your own. But I was thinking, is this how we actually talk about morality? Is this how we teach it to our kids? Why or why not? I have a funny story about that one later if it comes up. Is it strange that the four basic building blocks of character in Christianity are also the basics of Aristotle's ethics? He's a Greek pagan philosopher. Does that bother anybody? Other than faith, hope, and love, what's missing from these four cardinal virtues? Can you really fit all the good things you're supposed to be under those four words? So what'd you think about, those are just my questions. What'd you think about the four virtues, and is that what we think Christian character amounts to, as Lewis seems to think it is, other than faith, hope, and love, which get their own lesson later? So it's good that you bring that up. I don't want to get all technical or anything, but in rule-based ethics, all you need are a really good set of rules. Virtue-based ethics, how would you ever learn what a virtue looked like? my dear friend Cole Fakes just finished his dissertation this last year, and his dissertation was on using examples in the Bible for morality. How often the Bible says, be like that guy. Because if you want to imitate a virtue, you basically have to see someone else do it. So Paul will say things like, follow me in so much as I follow Christ, or have the faith of Abraham, right? You almost have to see it, which is why the Bible's full of stories. Yes, there are pages of rules, but also tons of stories. And then it says, do it like that. And the centerpiece of the New Testament, I know there's little letters where Paul gives us rules, but the longest books are four accounts of the life of Christ that say, here's what character looks like, be like this guy. So yeah, good examples are essential to developing a character-based strategy, because when I want to tell my son, be brave, I have to like point at something and say, like that. I have to have some examples, which is why it's so important to do morality together. Rules I could probably follow on my own, maybe, but character is something we develop with other people. When young people sit next to old people and talk about things, it's when they learn character. And you get it from examples. So, yeah, glad you brought that up. You were going to say something, I think? Yep. Yeah, so I think, yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. That's probably my answer to that one, is that Aristotle's a great observer of people, of what's going on. And he notices things and he says, you know, this courage thing is a good thing. Now, what breaks down is Aristotle can't tell you why it's good. So at the end, you say, why are these things good? He said, well, they are. And Christians say, because there's a God who is these things. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, society that teaches against them. For example, our society teaches against temperance. Indulge all you want. You know, have everything you want as far as you desire.
Or even, like, there's some part of society that teaches that way and some the other. How do I decide which is the virtue? Yeah. Well, if there is a God who is one as opposed to the other, then I say, okay, I know which one is the virtue, which one's the vice. If I'm just dependent on the guy who happens to live next to me, well, I guess that's where you're supposed to live, which is what we do. Why do we have cycles of family problems that repeat the same problem in a family over and over again? Because your moral example was a bad example. And so I learned, got my vices and virtues switched from dad, you know, whatever. Can move the whole thing. Yeah. Andy, go ahead. Yeah. The early church fathers were big fans of Aristotle, and they would say, hey, all truth is God's truth. I mean, the fact that Aristotle stumbled on it doesn't mean the fact that it was just true. Right? 2 + 2 = 4, and it doesn't matter who tells you that. It's because of God, and it's true. There it is. Right? So, yeah, I think that's right, that there are some things that God has just made obvious that we have to work to ignore. And so it doesn't surprise me when some pagan says, hey, you know, honesty is pretty good. Some of the really strong atheistic modern philosophers will still say things like, well, I mean, we need to be honest because they don't want to be cheated. I mean, that's a good thing. Yeah, what about that? Yeah. So interesting then, while it's not included in the four virtues, Lewis is going to have a chapter on what is the greatest sin, and it's pride. Because humility, a lack of humility undermines all the virtues. So yeah, I think maybe you could squeeze it in somewhere, but it's written into all of them. Without humility, I don't know how you could. You can't be courageous because you can't put anybody else ahead of you. You can't be fair because you can't care about anybody but yourself. You can't be restrained because nothing matters but your happiness, right? None of them work unless there's some brand of humility tied up. Pride is going to undermine all of it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the hardest things for morality is to know that it works. Like, if it's just up to me and the universe, how do I know if I tell the truth, it's even going to matter? Or that if I treat somebody fairly, maybe they treat me unfairly and then I lose. You know, I mean, but if there's a God in the universe who makes all things right and I can walk humbly with him, then I can trust that being fair and being courageous and being restrained and being prudent works out because it works with him. And it gives you a lot of courage. It comes from humility. Yeah. Okay. I think we're out of time. I hear children screaming down the hall, so that means probably soon. Next week, we'll get to how do we do this in a society, right? It's nice to have all these character traits inside of us, but what about social morality? What do we do amongst ourselves? How are we going to manage that as Christians? That'll be next week. Thank you.